You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Charlie Savage won the 2007 Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles about the Bush administration's use of signing statements on pieces of congressional legislation it doesn't like. He's expanded that series into a book called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. It's published by Little Brown and Company, and I'm very pleased it has brought Charlie Savage to this program today. Wow, Subversion of American Democracy. You're not pulling any punches here.
It's an aggressive title, but let me jump in by saying what I mean by that. What I mean is the subversion of American-style democracy, which is the founders' vision of a system in which, in between elections, no one wields concentrated government power, having checks and balances so that their power is divided, and we don't have a system in which any one individual, who may not be the best individual to be in that job from time to time because human beings are flawed, does not get to simply drive the country off the rails at their own discretion. That's the founders' vision of American-style democracy, and that's what's been changing so dramatically in the last 7 years.
Well, the debate over a strong executive goes back as far as the Federalist Papers and the nation's founding, and then Lincoln suspending habeas corpus. We had some other presidents who were rather strong-willed, Teddy Roosevelt, for example, FDR. But Arthur Schlesinger coined the term imperial presidency about Truman, didn't he? Is that when this whole process that you're writing about really began?
Arthur Schlesinger's wonderful book, 1973 book, The Imperial Presidency, is about the growth of executive power really just from the Truman years in 1950. Sort of the inaugural event is when Truman sends us to war in Korea on his own say-so without going to Congress for permission. That was the first time any president had ever done something like that for a major overseas war. And then presidential power escalated steadily under presidents of both parties, peaking with Nixon, and then fell again, although right after Schlesinger wrote that book, after Watergate and Vietnam.
With the excuse of the Cold War to expand that power?
That's one way of putting it. The Cold War provided the political context for presidents to invoke a sort of cult of commander-in-chief authority. I am the leader. I need this power. And also the geopolitical context of after World War II, we did not demobilize. We had a large standing army sitting around. We created a central intelligence agency, which started off just to gather information, but quickly evolved into a covert paramilitary force that presidents could use to take war actions on their own. And that was the climate in which the imperial presidency, as it originally existed, arose.
And every time anybody complained, the threat to our national security was invoked, because we did have the Cold War going on. And that ended, to some degree, with the Nixon administration, because Congress then wrote legislation to kind of undermine the imperial presidency.
Well, what happened in the mid-1970s was that the abuses of power that we know of collectively under the term Watergate and the disaster of Vietnam sort of combined to reawaken Congress from its 20-year slumber. And it began performing real oversight, especially on intelligence, for the first time in decades. And it began passing a series of laws intended to control and regulate executive power, which had sort of really ballooned out of control just in the hands of a few presidents. And really understanding that moment, that mid-1970s moment, is critical for understanding what has been happening today. Because at that moment, Dick Cheney, the current vice president, was the youngest White House chief of staff in history to Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford.
In fact, many of the prominent people in the Bush administration came onto the political scene during the Nixon-Ford years. So you're suggesting that some of them, anyway, have been attempting to restore the power that was taken away in the post-Watergate legislation?
There's no doubt. They've talked about this openly. Cheney has, throughout his career, and especially in recent years, whenever asked, he's explained that he thinks that these reforms in the mid-1970s were excessive, that whatever Nixon's personal failings, which he's not even willing to concede, but regardless of that, people in power in the White House can be trusted to wield power, and the world is dangerous and complex, and we need the sort of a presidential power at the very inflated level that briefly flourished under Nixon before he fell. And so he's been working for 30 years, along with others who agree with him, to restore presidential power to that level.
But hasn't it been kind of restored bit by bit since Ronald Reagan to some degree, then the first President Bush, Bill Clinton did things as well.
And one of the, this book is mainly about the Bush administration, but the first third of it is a history of executive power, including back to the Lincoln years that you referenced earlier, but especially from Watergate to the end of the Clinton years. And what you see is that even though there was this backlash moment in the mid-1970s, beginning in the 80s, a lot of those reforms had already started to erode away. A lot of, things like the Independent Counsel Law were allowed to expire. One president after another showed that he could basically defy the War Powers Resolution and send troops into overseas battle on his own, culminating in Clinton, a Democrat, in Kosovo in 1999, allowing the air war to go on for 78 days, even though that check was supposed to say, hey, if we don't approve this after 60 days, you've got to bring the troops home.
He also had a missile attack on Sudan, which may have very well have been on an aspirin factory.
Well, the larger point is that even though Dick Cheney, when he's publicly acknowledged this agenda of rolling back these reforms that he thought were excessive from the mid-1970s, has postulated it as if there's been this valley of executive power that's so weakened. Actually, most of those reforms were gone by the end of the Clinton years. And so instead of filling in a valley, they were really building on a mountaintop. And that's how things have gone so dramatically. Just in the last 7 years.
My guest is Charlie Savage. His book, Take Over, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, is published by Little Brown. You begin your book with an account of Dick Cheney's actions on September 11th, 2001. What do you think his behavior and President Bush's inaction that day revealed about how the next 6 years of their administration would unfold?
Well, that's right. I opened the book with this very vivid moment on the morning of 9/11 in which Cheney authorizes the military to shoot down any remaining hijacked planes. Now, this is not a very important moment because, as it turns out, all the planes were already down. United 93, the last of them, had already crashed about 15 minutes earlier, and they didn't realize that. But it's interesting as a sort of vivid illustration of Cheney taking command, especially in the 9/11 in the national security context, and then Bush acquiescing to what Cheney's already decided, because then Cheney calls Bush and Bush says, yes, I agree with that. But as a third level, their administration's efforts to control the flow of information about what's happening behind closed doors in the executive branch to the public, to Congress, because 3 or 4 years later, they tell the 9/11 commission that Bush had given Cheney permission to give this extraordinary order. Bush, of course, is the commander-in-chief, not the vice president, so it was important for that chain of command to be respected. Bush had given Cheney the permission to give this order ahead of time. But the 9/11 Commission went through 8 military logs from the White House command bunker, from Air Force One. They looked through the written notes of people who were in both the plane with Bush and in the command bunker with Cheney, and they found no evidence for that call. And so it seems to be an instance in which what was really happening and what we were being told was happening might have been in conflict. And that's symbolic because one of the ways in which this administration has dramatically expanded executive power and was doing this even before 9/11 was to ramp up executive secrecy, to build a stronger and thicker fortress around the White House so that people who are wielding power could not be held accountable very easily for what they're doing with it.
Do you think that Cheney's power has been curtailed a bit since because we've been made aware of a power struggle within the White House now over what to do with Iran? And he seems to be losing that power struggle.
I see no evidence at this point that Cheney's losing that battle.
I mean, but he seems to be pushing for an attack on Iran.
Yeah, we'll stay tuned.
You think that may happen?
Regardless, let me take a step back. This is, from the book's perspective and from the long-term perspective, this is not about any one policy. A particular policy might be, should we attack Iran or not over its nuclear program? But the bigger picture is establishing who gets to make these calls, whether the president can make calls like that on his own or whether he needs to go to Congress for permission, and all kinds of different levels. And so the powers that they've established, the precedents they've set, the actions they've taken showing that a president can sort of bypass the rules at his own discretion rather than going to Congress to have the rules changed, are that's what's important for the long term. And so even long after this presidency is gone and some future president is in power or some other person, 5 years from now, 50 years from now, the precedence they've established that a president need not go to Congress for all kinds of things is what is the lingering impact of this policy.
And even though Congress authorized war against al-Qaeda 3 days after September 11th, members of the Bush administration already believed that they had the power to go to war because of the attacks. Were they citing the Korean War as a police action as a precedent for that?
This is one of the things the book tries to do is explain to people who are not attorneys what are the legal theories that this administration has pushed and how, by taking actions based that are only legal if those theories are true, have they set precedents that support the fact that these theories are true. And so part of it is to explain their theory of commander-in-chief power, that the commander-in-chief has inherent unwritten powers because he's the official charged with protecting national security to do whatever he sees fit within armed forces and with the intelligence agencies to protect national security. So the Korean War is a great example of something that Cheney would look back to and say, here's an example of a president going to war without Congress. That shows it can be done. And in fact, when you look back at his career as Secretary of Defense to the first President Bush, he urged George H.W. Bush to go to war in the Gulf War without going to Congress for permission. Why? Because he said, Truman did it once. We can do it now. Let's revive that and show that it's always legal for us, for a president to take us into war on his own say-so.
Another way they've expanded on that is through the signing statements that you wrote your series about.
That's right. The centerpiece of the package of stories that I wrote last year for The Globe was about the use of signing statements. A signing statement is an official legal document that a president signs and issues and puts in the Federal Register on the day he signs a bill into law.
So he can sign a bill saying, yes, I agree with this bill, and then do a signing statement that pretty much undermines everything that's in the bill?
Well, the way it works is it instructs the executive branch about how they are to implement the statutes that are created by a particular piece of legislation. And where this becomes controversial is when he says, you will interpret Section 103 as being unconstitutional, and therefore it does not need to be enforced. And where that becomes very controversial is when Section 103 happens to be a constraint on the president's own power. He's saying, I have this theory of my unwritten powers under the Constitution, therefore this check on my power, like, for example, the McCain torture ban, like oversight provisions that were added to the Patriot Act, and so forth, are unconstitutional, and I can, set those aside at my own discretion. You don't need to obey them if I tell you not to.
But isn't that the Supreme Court's job?
Well, this is...
This is working like a line item veto, isn't it?
Well, this is sort of the insight. This is a previous presidents have done this. Reagan started doing it more frequently. Bill Clinton did it as well. But Bush has challenged more laws using signing statements than all previous presidents in American history combined. And at the same time, he stopped basically using his veto power. He didn't veto a bill until his sixth year of his presidency. And no one could really figure out why this guy who was so otherwise interested in, exercising executive prerogatives aggressively was not vetoing anything. And then once it came to light that he was using signing statements at an unprecedentedly aggressive clip, it sort of became clear that this is something that's sort of acting, as you say, almost like a line item veto. In fact, one that Congress cannot override because there's no mechanism for that. And it's just one more tactic among many that this administration has used to increase presidential power, to show the way for future presidents to take more action unilaterally all across the map.
My guest is Charlie Savage, who covers national legal affairs for the Boston Globe and has written extensively about President Bush's signing statements and other White House efforts to expand executive power. It earned him a Pulitzer Prize this year. And now there's a book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, published by Little Brown. We will continue our conversation after this. I'm back with Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, winner of this year's Pulitzer Prize for journalism. His book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, is published by Little Brown. We were talking about signing statements, but what happens when the law is already in place and a president doesn't want to go along with it? For example, there's a War Powers Act, isn't there? How does a president get around that?
So the War Powers Act was one of these post-Watergate, post-Vietnam Well, actually, Nixon was still in power, but almost at the end of his presidency, when Congress passed it over his veto. But one of these reforms of the 1970s, to say, wait a minute, the founders wanted Congress to make the decisions about going to war, and presidents have been chipping away with this, most notably Truman and Johnson. Let's put that genie back in the bottle. The War Powers Resolution said that presidents had to start consulting with Congress again before sending troops into overseas hostilities, and that even though they could send troops into some kind of quick strike situation, if Congress did not explicitly approve that operation, the troops automatically had to be brought home within 60 days. And presidents hated this. Nixon vetoed it, but Congress overrode the veto. Presidents of both parties started chipping away at it by taking more and more militant actions without consulting Congress. Finally, in 1999, Bill Clinton put the coffin nail in by allowing, as I said earlier, the Kosovo air war to go on for 78 days without explicit congressional permission.
But he said that Congress had implicitly approved his war.
Well, that's right. His lawyers came up with the somewhat contorted legal argument that because Congress funded the war by refusing to, you know, cut off supplies for the troops once they were already deployed, that meant that they had approved it. But the very terms of the War Powers Act said that that didn't count. Because, of course, Congress is not going to leave troops without ammunition and food in the middle of the battlefield, but that did not count as permission for the 60-day clock reason. But he had this sort of lawyerly contorted argument, which is something we definitely saw a lot of in this administration as well, to get around it. And because no one had standing to sue over such an issue, there's no individual victim of that policy over whom courts had jurisdiction, kind of what the executive branch said was the law to itself became good enough. And that sort of pattern is what we've seen playing out in more and more aggressive ways in this administration as well. It shows how executive power is not a partisan issue. We've had Democrats as president in the past, and we'll have them again as a future in the future, and they will be able to draw upon these same arsenal of powers to make whatever their own policy decisions are.
Does anybody have any standing to sue about whether a signing statement is constitutional or not?
Well, most of the time, no. On the most interesting ones, like torture, you know, if some detainee who's not a U.S. citizen in some CIA prison in Thailand is being tortured, no one has standing to sue over that. Or if Bush sends 800 troops to Colombia when the law says he can only send 400, no one has standing to sue over that. So most of the most interesting questions never get before the court.
This is an odd question, but if Congress passed a law said you can't issue any more signing statements, couldn't the president just put a signing statement onto that?
Well, of course. And he could just simply disobey it anyway. The question is, what is Congress going to do about it?
How much power would the Bush administration have been given had Congress capitulated on September 14th and inserted the words "in the United States" to the original resolution authorizing war against al-Qaeda?
This was the Bush administration. It was an interesting scene, those couple days on the legal territory, those couple days after 9/11. Because on the one hand, the Bush administration legal team thought that what Congress was going to authorize was completely irrelevant, because they have this theory that the president, as commander-in-chief, can do whatever he wants to protect national security at his own discretion. And so whatever Congress purports to authorize is at best redundant. But Congress was going to pass some kind of war powers resolution anyway, and they were then therefore lobbying Congress to include very sweeping language. They wanted the Congress to authorize the use of force, or at least support it, in domestically on U.S. soil as well as abroad, and against any potential threat, as opposed to just against the perpetrators of 9/11. They chose not to do that. And then secretly, the Bush administration said, well, it doesn't matter that they didn't do that. We can still do this on our own. Most of their legal theories, a way of to sort of explain it to non-lawyers, is sort of boils down to the idea that U.S. soil is a battlefield now. And therefore, because 9/11 showed that U.S. soil is a battlefield and there's the enemy lurks among us, therefore the president and his subordinates under his control exercise full battlefield powers here at home.
That means they could impose martial law?
They could impose martial law. That means, in theory, they could shoot someone they suspect of being a terrorist on site. They haven't done that, but we can see that they have held U.S. citizens arrested on U.S. soil by civilian law enforcement agencies, in the case of Jose Padilla, as an enemy combatant, without charges, without trial, at the executive's discretion alone. And they have wiretapped without warrants on U.S. soil. Why? Even though there's a law that says they have to get warrants? Because the theory is, well, this isn't just, you know, ordinary intelligence anymore. This is battlefield intelligence. And Congress cannot intrude into the commander-in-chief's power to collect battlefield intelligence as he sees fit, that is, or to, you know, hold enemy combatants as he sees fit, or to interrogate enemy combatants as he sees fit. All of these things are exclusively committed to the president. He has these powers, whether it's U.S. soil or abroad.
And they claim that the FISA law doesn't apply because it takes too long to get an okay to do these wiretaps?
There's a lot of haziness around why they didn't want to obey the FISA law. I think that's what they said. Well, there's a lot of paperwork involved.
How long could it have taken?
Well, in my judgment, probably it's a little bit different than that. They're using the National Security Agency's very powerful computers to data mine and process many phone calls all at once. You know, traveling, you know, millions of phone calls traveling through a fiber optic line. They're looking for patterns of suspicious behavior three or four layers out from some particular person that they're interested in. That means there's not probable cause ahead of time to listen to those phone calls, and therefore they could not have gotten a warrant. I think that's the sort of educated guess about why they really didn't want to obey that law.
Why has the administration pushed for greater secrecy in government when the enemy we're fighting has significantly less intelligence gathering capabilities than the Soviet Union had, even in the waning days of its power?
Well, I think that they see secrecy as an end to itself, first of all. I mean, one of the critical insights here is, even though we're constantly talking about this in terms of the war on terror and 9/11 and national security, this is much bigger than that. This began long before 9/11. This was discussed the day after inauguration in January of 2001 at the first meeting of the White House legal team. Alberto Gonzalez conveyed from Bush and Cheney to the new legal team, The president believes that the powers of the presidency have been weakened by his immediate predecessors, and that we're going to use this time in office to seize opportunities to expand presidential power as an end to itself, to leave the office stronger than it was when we arrived. And so the very first battle on which that was fought was secrecy before 9/11. Remember Cheney's Energy Task Force papers? There were laws that said when a White House has a task force like that, the public and Congress has to know what it's up to. That's why Hillary Clinton was forced to give up her health care task force documents 10 years earlier. But the Bush administration stonewalled, where the Clinton administration finally gave in. They fought all the way to the Supreme Court, and they won a precedent gutting those open government laws so that the president's secrecy powers would be increased. That's just one example of many in which their secrecy powers have been increased, which is in turn just one tactic among many they've used for increasing presidential power.
Well, just 10 days after the attacks, Chief U.S. Immigration Judge Michael Crepy sealed all deportation hearings from the public and media. And we've had Homeland Security Department allowing any employee to stamp any document for official use only. The Freedom of Information Act has been curtailed. And also the president, way before 9/11, sealed the records of all of his predecessors.
That's right. These are all ways in which I said that, you know, the Energy Task Force president was just one of many, and you just named three or four of the even, you know, 10 times as many examples. 9/11 provided a tremendous excuse to set precedent, saying that the president and the executive branch could keep even more information secret. But you're right, another example that predated 9/11 was the attack on the Presidential Records Act, another one of those post-Watergate reforms that said the president's records are the public property. 12 years after an administration leaves office, almost everything, including confidential advice to the president, has to be thrown open to the public and the historians at the National Archives. The first administration to whom that would have applied would have been the Reagan-Bush administration. But one of the first things they did in 2001, which was right when the Reagan administration's documents should have been made public, was to issue an executive order that basically gutted that law by making it impossible in practice for historians to actually get access to those papers, and by also extending that shield to vice presidential papers. So who were the first two beneficiaries of that? George H.W. Bush and Vice President Cheney.
My guest is Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, winner of the Pulitzer Prize this year. His book, Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy, is published by Little Brown. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You write that in April 2006, the House voted 327-96 to authorize the administration's war on terror plans, but only a dozen House members had actually read the bill. Why would such an important document be ignored by so many members of Congress?
This is one of the sort of questionable things that have arisen at the hands of multiple executive branches of both parties. This is not a system that this administration created, but it certainly has benefited from. The idea is that they will only there's secret laws, basically, authorizations for what's going to be done with the intelligence budget, or maybe the intelligence on which a vote, say, to go to war in Iraq or not, will be based. And the rule that they've somehow managed to get Congress to acquiesce to over the years is that if a member of Congress is briefed on that secret information, that member of Congress can never talk about it, even in broad strokes, on the floor of the House or otherwise, or of the Senate as well. And so even if, say, the New York Times gets a leak of it and puts it on the front page and everyone is talking about it, if you've received one of these briefings, you're not allowed to talk about it, because that would be confirming that it's true. And it's this sort of crazy catch-22, because that means that members of Congress don't want to be put in a box like that. They want to be able to go debate, hey, should we go to war in Iraq or not, or whatever. And that means that they've overwhelmingly now choose not to receive those briefings, and they choose to legislate behind a veil of ignorance so they can at least talk about the major issues.
Well, why do you think they've capitulated so much to the administration? Was this in the when the Republicans controlled Congress, you still would have thought that they would have wanted to have a bit more of a say in what was going on?
Well, this is just Congress, especially in the national security climate over the last 50 years. We saw this from Truman going to war in Korea and Congress doing nothing to protect their own prerogative to decide whether or not the country goes to war.
There was the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which
was a capitulation. It passed a sweepingly open-ended thing, the Gulf of Tonkin. But even that was not as open-ended as what Johnson did with it. That was authorizing military action for defensive purposes, to repel further attacks on U.S. troops. And of course, the question is, had there really been those attacks in the first place? But in the years following that, Johnson Americanized, the term is, the Vietnam War on his own, turned it into a massive offensive operation without going to Congress for further permission. And they sort of, again, sat on their hands, and we don't want to make these decisions. So I think what you're seeing is, in general, a reluctance on the part of the modern day people who get elected to Congress to play the role that the founders wanted them to play, to take that responsibility on their own shoulders.
One of the ironies of all this executive privilege is that Dick Cheney claimed he isn't part of the executive branch.
Well, that was this just sort of shows the malleability of relying on what the lawyers say you can do to achieve certain policy ends. Dick Cheney claims that the vice presidency is part of the executive branch when it increases his power, like when he wants to assert executive privilege, which is not a vice presidential power, but a presidential power. But then he claims he's not part of the executive branch when not being part of the executive branch would increase his power. In this case, in that other case, the power not to comply with internal executive branch regulations about revealing how often you've classified or declassified something. It just sort of shows the sort of malleability of legal opinions and the ability to sort of get a lawyer to write an opinion justifying whatever result you want.
A few months after 9/11, the president decided to pull the United States out of the anti-ballistic missile treaty because he wanted to create a missile defense system. Isn't it the Senate's responsibility to make decisions on treaties?
This is a very important way in which this administration has locked down a precedent expanding presidential power for the long term, one which everyone has forgotten and no one really paid attention to at the time. The question is, a treaty that has been ratified by the Senate becomes the supreme law of the land, the highest law of the land, according to the Constitution. And for most of American history, on those rare occasions when a president wanted to pull out of a treaty, he went to the Senate for permission. It went to Congress for permission. What the Bush administration did was show that a president could pull out of even a major ratified treaty at his own discretion. And Congress basically did nothing to say, wait a minute, we get a say here. At least the Senate gets a say. And what that has done is it set a precedent so that going forward, future presidents will be able to do the same thing. And so, again, showing how this is not a partisan issue, what if we have a very liberal president who's a pacifist? It could happen. And they say, I don't want to be part of NATO anymore. They could pull us out of NATO legally. Or a president says, I don't want to be part of the United Nations, and just do it, and that would happen. That's just one of the myriad ways in which presidential power has been ballooning in the last 7 years.
Well, whose fault is it? Is it the president's fault, or is it Congress's fault? For example, after months of criticizing warrantless wiretapping, trying to get documents on it, Congress then approved it.
I spent some time in the final chapter of the book, which is called The Politics of Presidential Power, that chapter, trying to think about how things have been able to move so far down the road just in such a short period of time. And, you know, you always have presidents who try to push the envelope for some particular policy end, like Clinton wanted to do the Kosovo War and couldn't get Congress to approve it and just did it anyway based on this sort of dubious assertion. But what we had on the one end was a much stronger push than normal because you had a White House that was systematically seeking to expand presidential power as an end to itself, fulfilling this vision that had been part of Dick Cheney's agenda since the 1970s. And on the other hand, you had fewer countervailing forces than usual. Congress didn't push back. Why didn't it push back? One factor is, for most of this time, we had one-party rule in Congress, and that set up a conflict of interest where the leaders of Congress had a leader, and that leader was the president, and they didn't want to criticize him or perform aggressive oversight or push back because that might diminish their party's popularity. But the other factor is this climate of national security crisis, a perpetual threat of foreign attack, has historically, in every country, including this one, always created a situation in which there's a greater deference and acquiescence to the person who happens to be the leader at that moment. We saw that in the 60s, in the 50s with the Cold War climate, and now we're seeing it again in the post-9/11 environment. And what you're alluding to is, even now, even after the one-party rule has gone away and we have split control of government again.
And this war in Iraq is very unpopular.
And the war in Iraq is very unpopular and so forth and so on. Yet in August, the Democratic Congress passed the White House's preferred version of the Protect America Act, which essentially legalized the warrantless wiretapping program, something that even the Republican Congress in 06 had refused to do. And here, the Democratic-controlled Congress being told right before they went off on recess, we're going to get attacked in August and the blood will be on your hands unless you approve this. And by the way, no oversight mechanisms even after the fact. Thank you very much. We're willing to pass it. And I think that shows that this dynamic is going to be with us in the long term, especially if we get a Democratic president in 08 or 09.
What about the courts? Do you think that John Roberts and Samuel Alito were chosen by the president because they might very well support expanding executive power?
Absolutely. I have an entire chapter devoted to Roberts, Alito, and then to a lesser extent Harriet Myers, who of course failed as the Supreme Court nominee. I went back through their papers in the National Archives. Both of them were Reagan administration lawyers. That's how they got their start. And, you know, when they were nominated for these first two Supreme Court vacancies in a decade, everyone was up in arms about social issues. They were evaluating them through the lens of things like, how are they going to rule on abortion rights? And I think that lost in the whole furor of that was a critical insight into why these particular individuals were selected. Because there was a very broad array of very, very conservative, qualified potential Supreme Court nominees, lower court judges and conservative legal academics. But tellingly, the administration chose all three times from a very narrow slice of the conservative legal universe. All three were presidential lawyers. All three had spent years marinating in fights over expanding executive power from the White House's perspective, and they were thus ready to bring a very deferential view and a sort of a maximalist interpretation of executive power to the bench in future rulings. And when you look back in their papers from in the National Archives from the Reagan administration, Roberts and Alito were each particularly aggressive on the side of presidential power. Even among their fellow Republican lawyers working for Reagan, they were taking a more aggressive view. They were embracing things like the unitary executive theory. They were chastising their colleagues when they failed to take the position that would result in the maximal amount of power for Reagan. And I think that that is precisely why this administration picked them in particular to be Supreme Court justices, therefore tilting the Supreme Court towards a more executive power-friendly direction, not just today and for Guantanamo or whatever the cases are, but in questions that will arise 10 or 20 years from now over presidential power.
I have to tell you, if I were elected president, I might see all of this as an opportunity for me to continue to expand power, no matter what my party, no matter what my political philosophy. Have we opened up a door that can't be closed?
Well, I spend some time thinking about this as well. I think that this has been the single most successfully implemented policy of this administration. They never talk about it, and they're hit all the time for doing things incompetently. This thing they did enormously ably. And they, from the very beginning and very systematically and very relentlessly, found ways to set precedents for the long term, which is indeed going to leave this office much stronger. And when you look back through history, even when there's periods of backlash, like after Watergate and Vietnam, as we talked about earlier, those periods tend to fade away pretty fast. New people come into power, new issues come into play, and whatever reforms people do manage to put through, Congress does manage to erode fast. Presidential power has historically acted like a one-way ratchet. It's much easier to increase than to roll back again. And that's why I think that this is going to be with us for the long term. And I certainly think that a President Hillary Clinton will not be shy about using whatever tools are available to her to achieve her policy ends. This is human nature, regardless of your politics. If you're in power, you want more power. You want to expand your power. You think you can be trusted with power, and you think you'll use power to do good things. And so it's just not likely that you're going to see presidents doing anything, really, to diminish their ability to carry out their will unilaterally.
Charlie Savage writes about national legal affairs for the Boston Globe. He won a Pulitzer Prize this year for national reporting, and his book is called Takeover, The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of American Democracy. It's published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.